This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Our guest in this portion of the program is Robert Oxnam. His accomplishments are many. Among them, he's a China specialist with a doctorate from Yale. At 38 years of age, he became president of the Asia Society. He's also a writer of fiction and nonfiction, but I suspect our guest might say his greatest accomplishment has been the integration of 8 of his 11 alternate personalities. Robert Oxnam was diagnosed in 1990 with multiple personality disorder. He tells the story of what he calls his inner evolution in the book A Fractured Mind, My Life with Multiple Personality Disorder. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon for our guest, Robert Oxnam. We look forward to your telephone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Robert Oxnam is visiting the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign for a talk today, April 10th, 2007, at 4 p.m. in room 180 of Bevere Hall. The invitation to speak at the U of I was extended by the Chancellor's Committee on Access and Accommodations in Observance of Disability Awareness Month. Tomorrow, the 11th of April, our guest will be in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. That event begins at noon. Both events are free and open to the public. A Fractured Mind, My Life with Multiple Personality Disorder is available in paperback from Hyperion Books. Again, the phone numbers 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Greatest accomplishment? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think it probably, yeah, definitely is. That, in fact, in the 1980s, before my disorder was diagnosed, I watched my life go in two directions. One was running a major institution, moving around the world, writing books. And the inside was just a kind of inner decay and frustration and eventually alcoholism and rehabilitation for that. But the diagnosis of multiple personality disorder led me to realize that I really had a fractured inner self. And that took more effort, more time, more angst than anything else I've been through in life. So, yes, I think that's my biggest accomplishment.
You begin the book's introduction with this sentence. All my life, now more than 60 years, I've felt a kinship with Humpty Dumpty, that hapless egg with human features who toppled from his perch. You want to elaborate on that?
It happens to be true. When I was a kid, I had this, you know, book of nursery rhymes, and there was this picture of dear Humpty Dumpty before and after. And obviously, to some extent, I related to that because it's abuse that produces fracturing in the mind, and that abuse occurred when I was a very young child. And so the question for me, I didn't know the word metaphor, I think, at age 5, but it was a metaphor for how could you actually take those pieces and recreate something akin to a whole personality? And that's been the challenge for my whole life.
Yeah. What is MPD, multiple personality disorder? Can you give us a little tutorial?
Yes. MPD, which is now called dissociative identity disorder by therapists, is the human response to extreme trauma, to extreme abuse. And it's usually physical or psychological or sexual abuse, often as a very, very young child. And what, in effect, happens is that the mind fractures so that only one part of it remembers the event, deals with the event. And the rest of the mind copes with trying to deal with the outside world. And therefore, there emerges inside yourself quite separate identities that have their own names, their own sense of self, their own memories. And oftentimes, that initial split then has further fragmentations to, in my own case, there were over 10 personalities who emerged. In some cases, there are over 50. But it essentially is a life in which memory is fragmented and identity is fragmented. And the therapy challenge, once diagnosed, is to try to slowly create a process of integration among some of them.
Yeah, your therapist, the psychiatrist, Dr. Smith, says it is a process of catharsis and integration.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. We can talk more about the castle later, but the castle is a metaphor for your mind, and it was constructed to protect you and the alternate personalities it held. It was also a prison.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'm not a specialist in psychology or in therapy, but I wrote the book in part because to both tell my own story, but also because I came to realize that quite a number of people from extreme dissociation. Almost all of the people that I know about have some kind of way of organizing the inner self. If you imagine having a great number of personalities inside you, they got to live someplace. And in my case, it was an adaptation, I suppose, of what every young boy has as an image, and that is a castle. But in our case, we actually embedded a castle in our mind, and therefore, you notice I use the plural, our case, because we still have multiple personalities, fewer today. And then each of those personalities occupied one part of the castle or another. The public personality stood on the parapet overlooking the moat. The private personality, the one you're referring to, was a young boy who was actually imprisoned in the dungeon of the castle for a long period of time. He was the one who was originally abused. And lots of others, all of whom had their own names. My name is Robert.
Mm-hmm.
The one who was on the outside was Bob. The one who was in the prison was Bobby. And the one who sat in the middle of the castle, the sort of philosophical, academic kind of guy, was, in fact, the me that you're now talking to. And it sounds very complicated to explain this. But, in fact, for one who has multiple personality disorder, these aren't makeup characters. They're the real construct of our lives. And it's only by embracing that reality and looking upon those components as real parts of you that you begin to go through a positive curve in terms of therapy.
Yeah. Who was the witch and how did she get into the castle?
The witch lived in a separate castle. The witch lived, and you notice that all of these are constructs that obviously come from a young child, but the witch lived in a black castle on a high hill above the castle that we occupied. And the witch, I now know, really represented the voice of the abusers. And like, I suppose, any witch, she scared us to death. And even you saying the name today sends a bit of a shiver through me. But she was the one who activated a process of what you would call on the outside self-abuse. Because an abused child, in this case Bobby, felt, as many abused children do, that they're bad, that they deserved it. We all grow up with love. If you don't get that love, then somehow you're to blame. And oftentimes the abusers say this is because you've been bad. And so the cycle of self-abuse, that is actually hitting yourself or burning yourself or cutting yourself, goes on with abused children and certainly does in this castle. So that was the job of the witch, to say you're bad and to continue to activate a process of self-abuse.
Yeah. You're very achievement-oriented, and that goes way, way back. And that also, it seems to me, to function as a protection. It's almost also castle-like.
Yeah. I came from a background in which there were different sides to it. And my father's family was pretty well known. My grandfather was a well known Methodist bishop, and he was on the cover of Time magazine back 40 years ago. My dad was a university president. So, on the one hand, I now know I grew up with some severe abuse from other quarters, and with an expectation that I would be a success. So there was a kind of impossible problem. And so to some extent, because of the subliminal awareness of this abuse and feeling bad, there was a sense that somehow you overcame that by becoming a super achiever. So I tried to do that in sports, in archery,
in sailing,
in bicycle racing, but also in academic terms. And to some extent, both the self-loathing and the belief in perfectionism made for an impossible situation. Eventually took me to a therapist's office.
Yeah. Well, how did you get to Dr. Smith's office, Dr. Smith?
I got to Dr. Smith after seeing a lot of other therapists. And this is, by the way, a very hard disorder to diagnose because the patient is hiding from something. That is, you don't want to admit the abuse. And oftentimes it's associated with other behaviors. In my case, bulimia, but also alcoholism, severe alcoholism. And I went into rehab, and the doctor who had diagnosed the alcoholism and insisted I go that very day to rehab was, in fact, a Dr. Jeffrey Smith, who, in addition to working with addiction problems, had also seen a number of dissociation patients. And he didn't immediately diagnose this, but about 6 months later, someone else popped up in the office, and it was that emergence of a personality over whom Bob, who was then the dominant outside personality, had no knowledge, no control whatsoever. A very angry, mean, fierce kid named Tommy, that he suddenly said, "Whoa, this clearly is a case of dissociation." My initial response to say was to say, "This can't possibly be," and it took me quite a while to see that this, in fact, was what had happened to me.
Yeah, how did you get to that point where you said, "It's real"?
Get to the point that
you said to Dr. Smith, "I see what you're talking about."
Well, I mean, my first reaction was that he's a quack. I mean, I'd gone to the office to.
After the
first thing that happened, and he said, "I met a kid named Tommy inside of you, and he hates me, and he's mad at the world, and he's fierce," and I said, "That just can't be." And then I went out, I suppose, revealing my academic background, and decided to read about three or four books about dissociation. I'd never read Sybil, the famous classic about dissociation. And I suddenly said, all these characteristics, that is, memory lapses, perfectionism, sense of self-loathing, I mean, all of those are part of the construct. And I slowly became a cautious believer. But then, indeed, once the dam had been broken, other personalities felt enough comfort in Smith that at least in the confines of his office, they came out and talked to him. And then after each one of these sessions, he would reveal what had happened because I had no memory of it. And it was only slowly coming to grips with that I recognized that here indeed was a pattern, and perhaps over time with a lot of therapy we could deal with it.
Yeah. There are skeptics about multiple personality disorder. They say these cases have been created by therapists and patients. What are your thoughts on that?
I have no doubt that that there are some cases, and I think a small minority of them, that we're in an era, after all, where people use the internet and they hear about the latest malady or whatever, and then it suddenly afflicts some people. I think there are few in the therapy profession these days who would most therapists operate, I think, with extremely carefully and not using suggestion, but watching what they see before them and going through analysis. There have been some legal cases where people have been accused by children, parents have been accused of abuse. They have brought in lawyers and, you know, there have been some test cases on it. But my own feeling is that it's a widespread disorder. It's an understandable disorder. It's a natural response of a little child to an impossible situation. And we know that abuse is just a terrible problem in our society. And my other reaction when I hear that there are a number of people who doubt it is, let's suspend judgment. Let's look around and listen to cases. Let's read books like mine and see what you feel. I can't convince people who start out by saying, this is impossible, therefore I won't read your book. But if you do read it, you still have the same impression, so be it. But I do think that 15, 20, 25 years from now, America will cope with, look upon dissociation as a major problem in our society that needs care rather than rejecting the fact that it could even exist.
Do you think that this can happen collectively? In cases where there's war and unspeakable horrors, Rwanda, where children and civilians are living in the most dire circumstances, Iraq.
There's no question that severe dissociation is a natural human response to trauma, whatever your age. There's no question in my mind that in societies which have suffered genocide, that it's a natural way to try to keep your psychic health in an impossible situation. That wonderful movie that won the Academy Award, Life is Beautiful, was the story of how a man sought to protect his son from the Holocaust,
yeah,
and the psychological damage of it. And so I think those of us who have dissociative disorders, which occurred in our own small human experiences, but with equal kind of ferocity at an early time, have just an enormous empathy for those who've gone into those experiences on a national or regional level. So I think in many ways, we may be as a society prone to dissociation because we suffer very severe traumas in a collective way. It's a great question.
Yeah, well, it was interesting to me that while you were in therapy, you're still working, you're still running the Asia Society, and you begin to see some parallels with your situation. It's the early 90s, and you're thinking of Tiananmen Square.
Yeah.
In 1989.
Well, there's no doubt about it. And I am a China specialist. I spent a lot of time there. I've taught at Beijing University over the last couple of years. And what happened on that occasion was, in fact, a national trauma. And it was also an international trauma because it was broadcast on TV. And I think perhaps an even more intense trauma was the Cultural Revolution, which preceded it, where maybe 20 to 30 million people lost their lives. And enormously successful people were sent off to the countryside and many of them actually committed suicide. That can, I think, have a traumatic effect for a whole society. And whether we can engage in collective dissociation or not, it's at least something which has crossed my mind.
That's interesting to think about. Our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine is Robert Oxnam. We're talking with him about his experiences with multiple personality disorder. He is the author of A Fractured Mind, My Life with Multiple Personality Disorder. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener now, calling in from Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hi. I used to counsel battered women, and if there's any one characteristic that seems true of all men who batter, it is that Jekyll and Hyde personality. And while I was listening to the women, some more than others, but there were some husbands, I mean, the women would tell me of the husband who sometimes would actually wear a particular hat when he was, it's almost like another personality. And another client said that her husband would use different names. And I had been pondering all this time and reading the book saying, oh, multiple personality is very rare. But in my mind, I had a lot of questions. I think I'll just hang up and listen to your response.
You know, it's a very interesting point you make. I guess it elicits two or three responses. One is I do not think that all abuse arises from a kind of severe dissociative abuser. I think there are a lot of people who can be overtly angry in a personality spectrum that is much closer to normalcy, often influenced by addictions, including alcohol. But there is no question that I have had to wrestle with my own response to abuse. Curiously enough, those who, and perhaps sadly enough, those who have been abused understand abuse as a way of behaving. You know, you grew up with it. And I have not engaged in physical or sexual abuse, but I often have had to, as I went through this therapy process, recognized that there are parts of me which engaged in emotional abuse and anger and even sometimes borderline rage. So I think it is true that those of us who have had DID have good reason to be angry, but also good reason to follow therapy so that we can find outlets for that anger, which are more integrative and end up as more benign. And so, I mean, that would be my initial response. One is that not all people who have this are the source of abuse, but that that those who do have it have to cope with the abuse that has become part of their lives. Incidentally, I think that abuse, the sort that you saw, is so much more widespread than we have recognized in our society, because so much of it is hidden. And I'm sure you saw some of that too, that where the abused person didn't want anybody else to know, and therefore it became hidden abuse. And my own sense is that families sometimes tend to pass along genealogies of abuse, where, in fact, each generation, in fact, passes it along until someone breaks the chain. So I really appreciate the question and hope you understand my answer is bifurcated, because I feel that we have to think about this as a problem which goes far beyond dissociative identity disorder.
Yeah. Hidden. Maybe it would be a good thing to talk a little bit about, get your thoughts on the roles that shame and secrecy play in why these things remain hidden.
I think for not only for abuse, but for a number of disorders and disabilities in our society, that we've gone through some remarkable changes in attitude, but where it's a work in progress. And therefore, I know that, speaking from my own perspective, that I spent the better part of 50 years hiding from my own secret. I mean, it took just an enormous amount of work to get me to recall what had happened as a child and the severity of it, which... And so, in part, that's a reason the hiding is built into that kind of suffering something, which you would think, I mean, here you're the victim, that you would scream out and say, how can the world do this to me?
It hurts.
It hurts. But what you say is you scream, but you then say, I must have deserved it. And as soon as you say that and someone else says, you know, you're right, you're bad. This is a punishment. You deserve this. You come to incorporate that, and that makes you want to hide. And they sometimes say, if you ever tell anybody, we'll hurt you or even kill you. So you grow up with that notion that it's a secret that can't be revealed. So I think that is part of it. The other part of it is that therapy and rehabilitation is one thing, but being able to deal with what was a secret all your life and, in effect, go public, not necessarily in writing a book, but in telling your family and friends and coworkers about it, is something that requires a social change and an educational change so that they understand too. So when people talk who have suffered abuse talk about hiding, they're really talking about the two faces, recognizing it first themselves, mm-hmm. and then having those, their loved ones, recognize it and help them through the process. Oftentimes, each part has a family member in the first case who says, this can't possibly be true. And so you have further reason to hide. Or you have someone else on the outside saying, oh, my goodness, this weakens the person. They're not going to have full capacities professionally or personally because they have a disability. Yeah. And I think we just need to change our attitude about not only DID, but many disabilities in our society.
Well, when it was clear that you needed help with the alcoholism, you told your coworkers, those that were around you, that you needed to go into therapy, into rehab, and that was really a nice part of the story. They were wonderful.
It's amazing that, I mean, my experience with alcoholism. Of course, alcoholism, you must remember, has as a disorder, which it is in its severe form, is much more widely accepted today, and there are mechanisms for coping with it. But nonetheless, I mean, going public, the response to that was extremely warm. Multiple personality disorder, especially when you say that term, has a it creates a sense of the term has a certain amount of anxiety built into it, a spookiness into it. And in fact, it's a much bigger thing than to take something which is a more unconventional diagnosis in terms of going public and to do that as well. But the response to my book, I would say, in terms of not only those who have reviewed it, but also those who are close to me, or even not that close, but I wondered how they would respond, has been much more positive than I thought. I'm so absolutely glad that I did it.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that there haven't been some that were in that category you talked about a moment ago, said this can't possibly happen, but they're a remarkably small minority.
Yeah. How did you decide you were going to write this book?
Well, it was partly that I revealed the story to a few close friends. And each time I did that, and, you know, maybe 10 or 20 people. And each time I did that, the response of those who heard it was, first of all, a kind of empathy, which was moving to me. But also, almost to a person, they said, you know, I got something like that, too. And I said, what do you mean? They said, well, you know, I act differently in different places. You know, when I'm at work, I'm one person. When I'm at home, I'm different. When I visit my mother, I'm different. And that I think that there is a kind of element of multiplicity in everybody's lives that my book was speaking to. The second reason that I wrote it was I've come to know that there are a lot more who suffer from different kinds of dissociated disabilities than we think. We're talking about lots of people because it's a natural response to trauma. So part of it was to reach in that direction. But the true bottom line is I feel better as a result. It was just simply darned good therapy because in the book, each of the personalities speaks in his or her own voice and in effect gave an outer voice to what was an inner therapy experience. And that, and it gets back to your first question, that probably is my biggest accomplishment, to let that happen and give them voice.
Yeah, everybody's out of the castles and onto the meadow.
Absolutely. That's our new metaphor, and we can see each other. We don't have walls between us.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
I have several comments and questions. One, the question relates to is, okay, let's just say there's 10 multiple personalities, and someone just to deal with an easy number. Is each personality highly integrated, or are these just like flickers of a central self, so to speak? If that is a clear question.
Can I answer your question serially? Because that one really deserves a response that's concrete.
Okay.
They are discrete personalities. They have different names. They have different memories. They have different outlooks. They, in their chronic form, they have different values. They have different ages. In my case, there are two inside me who have a different gender than my own. They're two women. They have, there have even been experiments that have been done that oftentimes they have different heart rates. They have different capacities for dealing with illnesses. And so it's important that one recognizes that fractured as one is with extreme dissociation, these individual entities think of themselves and look at the outside world as if they were the only personality. And it's our job through therapy to get to know all of those who exist within the structure. So they aren't just fragments of some kind of whole. They are, in fact, separate personalities.
Would each one then have their own sense of their own biography, a life history, and so forth?
Absolutely. And so when if you do get a chance to look at my book, A Fractured Mind, you will see that each of these personalities is speaking for himself or herself, telling their world, their worldview, their own biography, their own outlook on the whole process of therapy from unique perspectives. And it's important that one not look at these as sort of stick figures, or if a therapist looks at them without that notion of realness, it is a tremendous liability in terms of progress, in terms of moving towards a more integrated whole.
Okay. Fascinating. Now I have a question for you, too, another one. Back in the 80s or something, there's a great deal of stories about satanic ritual abuse and so forth and so forth. Do you feel there's a controversial topic, but do you feel there's any validity to that point of view? I'm thinking of, what was his name, Dr. Bennett Braun, I believe, up in Chicago, at Rush Presbyterian, who eventually got sued.
I did not experience myself ritual abuse. I know of a number of cases where it has in fact happened, whether it's part of a single cult or multiple cults, or simply a way of turning the whole process of abuse into something that has cult-like overtones. I do know of a number of cases, and I would guess that whenever one sees the tip of the iceberg, there's a good bit more there. But I don't have any personal experience in it. I want to emphasize, I'm not a therapist. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a psychologist. I'm somebody simply telling my story from the inside out, and some things I've heard by hearsay from others.
Okay. Well, very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are invited. Other questions? 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, Robert Oxnam. His book, A Fractured Mind, My Life with Multiple Personality Disorder. He's visiting the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign for a talk today, April 10th at 4 p.m. in Bevere Hall. The invitation to speak at the U of I extended by the Chancellor's Committee on Access and Accommodations in Observance of Disability Awareness Month. Tomorrow, the 11th of April, 2007, our guest will be in the Author's Corner of the Alana Union Bookstore. That event begins at noon. Both events free and open to the public. Again, questions are invited, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. In the book, you tell readers that you, Robert, you were lodged deeply, deeply within the castle. What did it take to get you center stage?
What it took was a willingness on my part to accept the diagnosis and therefore even to have Bob, the outer or dominant mm-hmm. personality at the time, discover that I even existed. But it also took, and I want to emphasize this point, anybody who suffers from dissociation or any of the characteristics that I'm talking about should immediately seek therapy help. And there are a lot of outlets for that, both in the university world and in private communities. But finding the right therapist is key. And therefore, the process that we went through was almost a detective, a kind of internal detective mystery, figuring out what made you tick. And Bob thought he was, for a long time, the whole personality. And it took him a while to look inside and to see that there were these other elements, a long-suffering Bobby, a frightening witch, a little boy named Tommy who beat up Bobby, and to find out that there also was a much more quiet, less charismatic kind of personality than Bob, who sat right in the middle of the castle, watched all of these things unfolding, but had never played the dominant role. And that happened to be Robert, me, who eventually emerged. Bob burned out, literally, and therefore part of what led to me was a deal that I had with Bob, that a lot of his characteristics and his network of connections and all would be transported to me, but I had to agree to play a more dominant role. And so what you have is almost a merger and acquisition process happening within inside your own mind. How does that happen? Because in addition to seeing this possibility, a therapist is standing there or sitting there and nurturing it, not pushing it too hard, but not stopping it from happening. Because ultimately, back to Humpty Dumpty, you can't put all of Humpty Dumpty back together. You have to put pieces of it, and then the whole starts to emerge out of it. So that's how it happens. Mm.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller, I believe, on line 4. Good afternoon. Where are you calling from? Is there a listener there on line 4? Hi, go ahead.
Hi, yes. I'm just curious about sort of the mechanics of writing the book. If personalities were discrete, how did your guest go about accessing each personality to tell the story in his book? Thanks.
A good question, and it'll become more apparent if you get a chance to read the book. But essentially, therapy occurred in two parts. The first part was several years of going through the process of identifying all of these personalities, starting the beginnings of a flow of inner conversations among them, and most importantly, finding out the true nature of the original abuse, which caused the fracture in the first place. Part two was learning then to live with the fact that we had a semi-merged structure. Some of them began to come together just as Bob emerged into Robert, me. But the second part of it was actually changing the architecture altogether. And this impish, everybody, by the way, if you read the book, tends to focus not on Robert, this is a frustration for me, but on the much younger entity, a kid who was a teenager named Bobby, who was long suffering and finally decided to break out of the whole system and literally engineered what is a mental escape into a completely different architecture, which is a meadow where there are actually three personalities who remain. And those personalities are what we see today. Each one of them represents a collection of mergers of other personalities. So today, the mechanism is that when an issue, an idea, a problem comes from the outside, we look upon it and genuinely, I'm speaking here, that we look upon it as a committee response that we have to produce so that we can have what I call cohesive multiplicity, a way in which all of the entities are involved in most of what happens on the inside and out. So that's both the mechanism of how it happens on the inside, but also what it looks like from the outside today. It is much more cohesive.
Yeah, cohesive and collaborative is another word you use.
Yeah. It's my own view that because, as I said earlier, that even those who don't suffer from extreme dissociation, that we all have these sort of different persona, not personalities, but different roles that we play in different places. So, I mean, part of the challenge for those of us who have dissociative identity disorder is to make the parts come together and collaborate. But actually, it gets closer to what is a much bigger human dilemma, or much more widespread, and that is to take the different parts of us who sometimes respond the way we want to and sometimes don't, and get those parts talking to each other. And so, in a sense, we're kind of meeting in the middle here. But extreme dissociation, the mechanism is not familiar to most people because you don't even have the basis for collaboration. You don't even recognize the identities of others within your own mental structure. So that's where we are today. I hope that answers it, and I hope that if you take a look at the book, you'll understand it better.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how the committee meeting works? And are there times when it's, you know, it's time to convene and it's time to call it off? I mean, we've all sat in committee meetings where it's like, enough, oh, God, enough, enough.
My life is a permanent committee meeting, if you can imagine that. But it's not the sort of committee meeting where we all see each other dressed up sitting around a table. We see each other as sort of inner entities, and we recognize the components of a personality, but we're not really looking at faces. And the communication among us is more like instant mail. It just keeps happening all the time. And the goal is to achieve a certain kind of consensus. I've tried to, this is not the easiest disorder to try to explain to people who don't have it, but I have a metaphor, and that is we all went to camp when we were young. We all sat around a bonfire, which drew us together. We couldn't see people's faces, but we'd been at camp for a while, and we all knew their personalities. And communication and cohesiveness occurred around that bonfire. But you also knew who had had an argument with whom and whose boyfriend had broken up with whom and so forth. And so there was a kind of shared knowledge. And to some extent, that's what it's like inside. But it happens with enormous speed. When it works well, it works quite well. And when it doesn't work well, it falls apart again.
We're right at the end of time. Let's take one more call, but it'll have to be quick. Listener on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering how you could hold a responsible job. Did you have any control about when you were going to be which person, or how did that work? Or could you break out into another person in the middle of being involved in some work?
That's an extremely good question. And what preserved the professional life in all of this was an ironclad but unwritten rule that when we were in a public professional situation, while all kinds of things could and often were going on inside, that there would not be what we call splitting, moving into other persona, because that would violate the fundamental goal of trying to not appear bad, but to appear successful. that it's extremely stressful, frankly, holding that together, because it means often putting the lid on all kinds of things that could be bubbling through. But it also means even today, even before I came into this studio, we all sat down and recognized that we had a part in conveying what I'm now saying. So there is a multiple basis for the words that are emerging here, but you can be darn sure that in a public setting, including on a wonderful radio program, splitting is not likely to occur.
Yeah. It's all about survival, after all, right?
It's all about survival. Yeah. It's all about survival, but it's about survival and trying to find the values that hold us together. And it produces within us an enormous sense of humanistic empathy, because you have to have that to hold the inner structure together. And the privilege then is that you find yourself talking in warmer, more connected, in some cases even more loving terms to people around us, because that's what you've had to do inside to survive.
Mm. There we have to leave it. Robert Oxnam, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Robert Oxnam is the author of A Fractured Mind, My Life with Multiple Personality Disorder. The book is available in paperback from Hyperion Books.